You forgot the first rule of remakes, Jill. Don't fuck with the original.
Hey everyone! Before Midnight is out in theaters, and you know what that means?
Another edition of Don't F With The Originals?
That's right! I'm Dimitri, editor-in-chief of Idiomatic.com and movie critic.
And I'm Nicholas, video game correspondent for Idiomatic.
So, as I mentioned, Richard Linklater's Before Midnight is out, and as you might have guessed, that means we're going to talk about the original movie that started the trilogy, that's Before Sunrise.
I'm kind of surprised the trilogy, though, but, you know.
Yeah. Before Midnight came out.
Yeah.
I could never figure out which one was the first, Before Sunrise or Before Sunset. Just in terms of titles. Like, obviously, when you see the movie, there's one that says, like, hey, remember when we met 9 years ago? You know that's the second one. But in terms of title, every time, like, oh, wait, which one is that?
Twilight makes it clear. It's a clear progression, you know, from, you know.
From Twilight to A New Moon to an Eclipse to a...
exact kind of logical progression, you know, sort of, I guess. Go Twilight.
Go Twilight. And that's why Twilight is better than Before Sunset.
Oh my god. Get angry emails.
Hipster heads exploding everywhere. Okay, so obviously this is a beloved movie. I kind of wish Chris was here because he loves this franchise. For those of you who don't know who I'm talking about, Chris from the Dreamer's Edge podcast. If you want that sort of opinion from somebody who loves that stuff and breathe it, come check us out at Idiomatic.com, the Dreamer's Edge podcast. He's there regularly. He loves that sort of stuff, but he's not here, so we're going to keep on talking. Hey!
All right.
Yay! So, we have a lot of material to go through, and the synopsis is going to take all of 5 seconds.
Okay, 1, 2, 3, go.
All right. So, Jesse, an American traveler, is in a train from Budapest to Vienna, meets a French traveler by the name of Celine. They hit it off pretty good. They start having a conversation, which leads into an entire day spent together in Vienna, or rather an entire night spent together in Vienna, where they have sort of the encounter of a lifetime. And that's pretty much it.
Indeed.
I know, 25 seconds instead of 5, right?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I was looking at my watch there. You're going a little bit over time there.
A little
over.
Ah.
You can just speed up the tape there.
So the big hook of the movie, for those of you who haven't seen it is an hour and a half of just two people talking. Nothing else happens, be warned. That's all it is. And whether or not you're into the conversation is the big key here. The beauty of it is that it is a special conversation. It is a conversation that feels more like real people talk than Hollywood people talking in that functional way.
Okay.
Having said that, I know for a fact that you don't like this movie at all.
Well, you know, when they meet on the train, mm-hmm. and he talks about a project he has, he wants to do on community TV of filming like 365 people for 24 hours, just filming their life for 24 hours and then showing it on TV. And then her reaction is like, wow, that will be completely boring. Well, I completely agree with her on that point. Yeah. That's pretty much how I felt about that movie. I mean, yeah, they're having conversation, they're falling in love, but it's, you know, this is a conversation I would rather be having with another person than listening to people I don't know having. Mm. You know, it's like a true, real conversation, and those are conversations you have every day, and I don't see the point of sitting down and looking at two people having a conversation, a regular conversation on screen. You know, if they're talking about, you know, aliens attacking the Earth, you know, that's something that, oh, this is new to me. This is interesting. I haven't seen that. I would totally be into that. But them, you know, I'm falling in love with you. Oh, that's great. I'm falling in love with you too.
Well, they never say that, though.
No, I know, but I'm
it's a bit smarter than that.
Yes, it is. I'll grant you that it is a lot smarter, but, you know, I'm paraphrasing because, you know, it wasn't thrilling for me. It was just, okay. Okay, they're going to the next place. What are they going to talk about now? Okay, yeah, okay. Next place. I will give that to the movie, though. Vienna is beautiful.
It's gorgeously shot, isn't it?
Yes. That you know, it makes me want to go and visit the city. Okay. So, I don't know if, you know, it was actually shot in Vienna or if it was shot to make it look like it was
in
Vienna.
No, it was shot on location.
Okay. But, you know, I want to go see the city. So, you know, city of Vienna, that job well done making me want to visit you. But besides that, I mean, I was just looking forward to the next set. Where are they going to be? And when they're in a bar or a cafe, you're kind of disappointed because, you know, you're not showing me anything now. You're showing me the inside of a cafe
Boring. It's also the crappiest bar. Like, the club they end up playing pinball in, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, that looks like a dive.
Yeah, yes, it does. And it had a cover fee, didn't it?
Yeah, it did, yeah.
And it was empty inside. You're like, what was the line outside for it to be empty inside?
No, I think they were just smoking and having drinks outside.
Oh, okay.
Like, I don't think they were in line.
Okay.
Because if they were, they totally cut into the line.
He's American. He can do whatever he wants. Okay. But yeah, it was like, I guess it was empty because there was a cover charge. Yeah, it was really a dump. When he goes to buy, he doesn't buy a bottle of wine. He kind of barters some wine to another bar. It's like it has those neons on the side there. It really doesn't look like traditional Vienna, what you expect of you, beautiful old Vienna. It's like, yeah, this is also kind of a dump here.
But at the same time, I think it adds to the charm. Like, it's not a travel guide movie. It doesn't show you the big monuments and the big. It shows you Vienna as you probably would experience it if you actually go there for real.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's what I like about traveling, you know, yeah. just go to a city and just walk around and try not to get lost.
Yeah.
Which they didn't seem to care about. So,
you know. Well, no, they're in love and they're having that connection moment. They can walk around, especially since they're just killing time, especially.
Yeah, that's true.
Because all she needs to do is get back on her train and they know where the train station is.
Hopefully.
And all he needs to do is get onto a bus to the airport. So yeah. Not exactly complicated.
Yeah, that's true.
So obviously I like the movie more than you did.
That's an understatement.
I think for me what really works is I guess I should say start by saying that I'm not surprised you don't like the movie. Given all that I know about you. We've been doing this for a couple of episodes now, so maybe some of our listeners may have figured out that you like escapist entertainment more.
Yeah.
You like a movie to transport you into a different place as opposed to the movie presenting a recognizable universe to which you can relate.
Yeah.
I'm actually kind of the opposite. I don't mind being transported to another world, but I sort of like to have an anchor where I can still find a thing relatable, which is probably why I disconnect from movies like Lord of the Rings, where it's like, yeah, dragons, sorceries, whatever.
Yes, yeah. I guess being so used to video games as well, where it's like every time a whole new world, you know, because it's very hard to make Earth recognizable, especially in the early times, you know, early video games. You know, this is New York. Oh, yeah, I can see the three sprites that make the Statue of Liberty. Good job making it New York. No, okay, they create all new worlds because it's a lot easier. So I'm guessing that's why probably I like those escape things where, you know, create something for me and I'll enjoy it, you know.
Yeah, and it's also the spectacle aspect. Because when I say Lord of the Rings, it's not that I disconnect because there's a dragon in it. I disconnect because none of the characters feel particularly human to me, really. Mm-hmm. They're just sort of archetypes. And that's sort of what it does. Like, I don't blame Lord of the Rings for doing that because J.R.R. Tolkien, is sort of one of the first to expose that to such a degree in creating such a consistent universe.
Okay.
So the archetypes become very useful in doing that, because you don't have to sort of give tons and tons and tons of background. You can just sort of like, he's a sorcerer and he's a good guy, or he's an innocent guy, he's a guy in search of adventure, he's a guy with a guilt complex, so that you don't spend too much time on trying to figure out who this person is and more time on understanding the consistency of the universe.
Yeah.
But that's exactly where I stop caring, unfortunately. So a movie like Lord of the Rings becomes far less efficient to me than a movie like Before Sunrise. And you thought for sure that I had completely digressed, but I was leading somewhere.
No, I actually thought for sure you were going to say Before Sunset, which would have been funny. But okay.
Their conversation feels very real to me. I've had some degree of similar conversations. Not to the degree they have. Like, I know a lot of people, we know a lot of people who have traveled and have opened up to a stranger in that exact way, because it's actually remarkably common in our generation, at least.
Okay.
Which makes sense. I mean, you travel, you're already in a different state of mind, because, you know, if somebody approaches you and is like, let me share my soul with you when you're going to work, you'd be like, shut up, I'm going to work, you know?
Whereas... That's cold.
But you would be like that, because you're in a different state of mind, whereas when you're traveling, it's like, hey, I got time to kill, let me discover you, you know? It sounded super pervy the way I said it, but, you know... And the fact that it is, the matter that exposes how you fall in love in the space of one conversation rings very true to me. There's some really specific, interesting beats going on the level of honesty with which they deal to me is very intriguing. Because they start off, they meet and they have that sort of regular conversation. And right off the bat, he sort of takes her off guard, Jesse, that is,
yeah,
by having this sort of pseudo-intellectual conversation where he's like, it feels like he's sharing an intimate part of him by going like, oh, you know, I'm having these weird thoughts in the train like this show that you're talking about, which I agree with you. Sounds like a terrible idea for a yeah. show. But then again, that's the point. He's sort of a hipster douche. Like,
although we do have Big Brother now, which is that for Trevor you can watch on the web. So I guess we're completely wrong.
That's a good point.
So, wow, they were precursors of the reality show. Oh my God.
Well, he was. Jesse invented the reality show. That's what happened.
Wow.
But, you know, it sounds like a deep thought, but it's not. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you can almost imagine him saying that same shit to every girl he meets. Yeah. That's his defense, sort of. I'm trying to seduce you, and I'm trying to hint at intimacy, even though I'm not really giving you anything. It becomes clearer when they're on the bus while they're in Vienna, and he asks her, like, hey, let's play Q&A. You have to answer the truth. You have to answer the truth. He asks a question. She reveals very intimate details about her youth. She asks a question to him, and he turns it into a big joke and never actually answers the question.
Yeah.
He's not being fully honest despite pretending to be opening up, you know? And that's true of a first date. Like, that is true. And I think it's very cleverly written the way that the writer-director, I should say, analyzes what that type of conversation is in real life and sort of transports it to the screen, having sort of dissected every beat of such an encounter.
Okay. And as the night progresses, I'm guessing, you know, the date become, it's like, is it more like the date progresses, or is it like more and more dates because they're spending so much time together?
No, I think there's a real connection that is forged from it, mostly because she calls him on his crap, you know? Like, okay. there's two scenes that are interesting where he sort of reveals his hipster douchiness a lot more, where, you know, they meet a fortune teller.
Yeah.
And the fortune teller, obviously, you know, fortune teller's not real, even in that universe.
Yeah.
And she's just doing some reading, palm reading, and, you know, it's just the generic stuff. But she's saying sweet things that are sort of romantic and cute and poetic in their own right. And Celine is sort of like, oh, that was fun, that was cute. Like, she doesn't actually say that she believes in it or anything. She's just like, that was fun. And he's like, well, you know, that's all fake. And he's like, I'm the smartest guy in the room still, right? Right? And it's like, calm down, buddy. Calm down.
Yeah.
Then they have another encounter with
a poet.
A poet, exactly. Yeah. Where instead of asking for money, the poet goes like, well, tell you what, give me a word. I'll write a poem about that word. And if you like the poem, I'll give it to you. And maybe you can give me some money for the poem, which is actually kind of neat. Like,
yeah.
If you're going to ask for money on the street, I think you should do stuff like that. That's pretty cool.
That's pretty hard to do, though. He must be a pretty good poet.
Yeah.
I could maybe do a haiku in that time, but,
you know. I tried to do a haiku with milkshake, but
milkshake is cold. Brr.
Brr, 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 brr. And again, he has the same reaction where she's like, wow, that was a lovely poem. He's like, well, he probably wrote it before, right? You realize that. I'm still the smartest guy in the room. And what's kind of cute is that she doesn't ignore that. She sort of calls him on it. I was like, my God, you're insecure, buddy. she calls him a rooster or something, or a rooster dick or something like that. It's actually kind of cute.
Yeah.
And so that forces sort of intimacy because he can't rely on his usual tricks because she's perceptive enough to sort of call him on it. And she has her own flaws too. She's sort of steadfast. She sort of retreats in herself when a subject gets too confrontational because she doesn't like to let go of her ideas. But when the ideas are too challenged, she just stops talking about them. She does that when she starts talking about feminism, and he starts sort of challenging her views about that. And her views are not simple. They're very complex views. He's asking legitimate questions about them. And she's like, okay, I'm done with that conversation. It's like she just cuts it short, you know?
Yeah.
And he also notices. So because they call each other on each other's shit, I think there's a connection being forged that way.
And okay.
I find that's also true. I think the women I've fallen in love with I can distinctly remember when I've fallen in love with them, when I've decided, I was like, oh my god, this chick is awesome. And it's usually when they call me on my shit, or when they say something really smart and interesting about the world that I sort of didn't expect at that exact moment.
Okay.
So that's something I could really relate to in terms of how their connection is forged.
That's interesting. I fall in love with a chick when I learned she plays video games, so it's completely different.
And at the same time, there's false intimacy. Is also, the movie's really honest about the fact that this sort of encounter that feels like you've bared your soul, only to a certain degree.
Yeah.
She only admits his feelings to him by faking a conversation with her friend, by going like, oh, pretend I'm you're my friend and I'm calling you. And then she says how she feels about him. And it's just because, like, yeah, it's really awkward to say that in a person's face and not go like, yeah, they're going to run out the door, you know? Yeah.
That's weird, though, because that conversation on the phone felt even more awkward to me than just saying it directly. I would be in there and, like, other people like, what are these two doofuses doing over there?
And the beauty of that kind of scene, though, is, like, it's also introduced by just showing the cafe, where they show everybody having intimate conversations at a cafe, because that's what a cafe is for.
Yeah, I guess. Or drinking coffee, either or.
Yeah. More about the main heroes, I think it represents very much Jesse and Celine's conversation, how we think in our 20s. It's full of very abstract ideals and sort of steadfast positions on issues.
Yeah, and I remember being like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what I think is why the movie is celebrated, because it's written in such a way that you really can believe in these characters in a way that you can't necessarily believe in characters in most movies.
Okay. So you think that character, that movie more resonated towards that age group, like, you know, teens to, you know, early 30s, or, you know, I think everybody from, you know, even late 60s loved that thing, you know?
Well, I think younger, there's no way you can relate to it.
Okay.
I think older, maybe you might remember how you were when you were of that age.
That's interesting.
And another thing that's interesting, just on a filmmaking point of view, and I know I'm rambling on, it's just because I know you sort of like, yeah, the movie was boring.
Well, you know, I can describe the flash game I was playing, you know, while I was watching the movie, if you, you know, really care for that.
Well, actually, let's digress about the game. There's a scene where they play pinball while talking.
Yeah.
And you can actually see the pinball machine. So the actors are actually playing pinball for real while saying their lines.
You can see them play the machine, but it's shot from the side. So you don't see the ball actually going anywhere.
Well, it depends which shot.
Yeah.
It depends which shot. There's the shot when mostly she plays, especially, where you can't see it very well. But when he plays, they take a different angle. You can see.
Yeah, he's pretty good.
He's playing for... Yeah, he is pretty good. And I think the actors were playing for real and were just switching places for real while saying their lines, because you could tell, like, Celine or Julie Dipley was, like, really losing patience with it, where she's like, damn it, like I can't last more than 5 seconds. Like, every time they switch places, and she's like, oh, I just started and I have to switch place again.
Yeah, she was really, you know, I don't think those curse words were actually in the script. I think she's just, you know, merde. It's like every time, and she's just moving around again.
Because she never stays there for more than 2 seconds. Yeah. It's hilarious.
Which I don't get, because pinball is probably the easiest game ever. As long as you're not unlucky and it doesn't go straight through the middle, you know, you should be fine.
Yeah, but actually, I find that's the thing with pinball, though. There is a zone that you don't control. It is the size of the ball, and if it goes in that zone, there's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
And that happens actually remarkably a lot. I find that the pinballs are often designed to maximize the chances of that ball falling in that
hole. I don't know. I think the trick is not to aim for anything. Just keep the ball in. If you start aiming for stuff, that's the stuff where the ball is going to go back. I just shoot, and if stuff happens, it happens. I just end up playing very long time, you know, because I always get the ball back on the flippers. Hmm. That was a tip for pinball for you kids.
Yay! But now that we're in the nitty-gritty of it, that's the thing. The pinball scene and all the stuff. You mentioned how Vienna looks gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's a movie that's very cleverly shot, because it's, you know, it's an hour and a half of two people talking. There are only so many ways you can shoot Ethan Hawke's face before it gets really boring. And I find that the movie actually finds clever ways of always keeping the visuals fairly dynamic.
Yeah, the pinball was one thing, you're right. I didn't, you know, you don't think about it when you're watching it, but not looking back. Yeah, you know, that was a completely different scene where they're just, you know, pretty much rotating around each other as they're playing the pinball game. Other times they're walking next to the, I think it's the Danube in Vienna.
Yeah, yeah. There is one disappointment I have at some point, because they do meet other characters once in a while, but they just stay for about the length of a scene.
Yeah, when they first get into Vienna, I think is the only time they really talk to other people.
Yeah, pretty much. And they meet two guys who at first are pretty moderately hostile in that sort of Euro trash, passive-aggressive way.
It was funny.
Hey, it was great. Yeah. It was a great scene. Yeah.
It's like, you know, they ask, do you speak English or something? And, you know, basically the first thing the guy asked was, why can't you guys speak German? Why can't you guys ever speak German?
It was just for once. For once.
And what was that supposed to mean? It's nothing, nothing.
It turns out it's two actors who are, well, amateur actors.
Yeah.
That set up this play about this sick cow that thinks it's a dog.
Set in India, I think. Yeah.
That play sounded like the most awesome thing ever.
I know. And I was hoping, I was like, they're going to have to go see that play. Come on. I was thinking, okay, they're only spending one night in Vienna, so that might be too long just to see the whole play. But I want to see that play with that actor that was so proud he was going to be playing that cow. It's like, I want to see this. And it never reached the play.
I know. And they, but it's not the screenplay has forgotten, because they bring up the play again near the end.
Yeah, like we missed the cow play. It's like, yeah, you did.
I guess it shows how in love that they are, that they would be willing to miss that awesome sounding play for their conversation. It means they're really into each other, because there's very little that would have kept me away from that play.
Yes.
Okay, I have a question for you, and this goes into mild spoiler territory, people, but since you know it's a trilogy, you probably have an idea of where the story is going, but
yeah.
It ends with them promising to see each other again in 6 months.
Yeah.
Now, taking aside the fact that there are sequels.
Let's not talk about that. Let's worry about the sequels later, because exactly. I didn't see them. Okay.
Do you think that they're going to meet in 6 months?
The fact that they did not take contact information, I'm saying no. There's always stuff that happens, even in if you have the best intentions. You say, okay, I'm going to see you again in 6 months. And, you know, 3 days before you're supposed to leave, you break your leg. You know, well, you would really want to see that person again, but you can't fly or you can't travel because your leg is broken. Well, then you just lost your opportunity. That's why you grab a phone number. Mm-hmm. Even if you say, give me your phone number and I'm not going to call you. I'm only going to call you if there's something happens and I can't make it. At least do that. But no, they're like, let's meet on that day at this time and then bye-bye. It's like, yeah, I don't think they have any intention, one or the other, of showing up.
I tend to agree, for slightly different reasons, but you bring up a good point, though. And they are very explicit about not giving each other contact information. It's not like it's a plot hole in the writing. No. They bring it up, and those kids really don't want to give each other contact information. And for me, it's more that they've romanticized their little day together to such a point that I think it would be intimidating to come back to it. You'd be afraid of it being disappointing or blah, blah, blah. Or you'd just be afraid of looking like a jerk if the other doesn't show up again. I think
it's not like a jerk, more like an idiot if the other doesn't show up. You feel like a jerk if you don't show up and then you learn that the person was there.
Jerk in the pre-80s sense.
Oh, really? I didn't know there was different senses to the word jerk.
Yeah. Jerk is an idiot, pre-80s.
Oh, interesting.
Like, especially these two, I think at least one of them would have been like, I prefer to keep this ideal of this other person and never challenge that ideal, never endanger it, and so they wouldn't show up.
But they do they even have ideals? Because they know that the other person is not perfect. As you mentioned before, they've pointed out, you know, they know each other's, you know, defects, and you know they've been called out on them. So,
but they're not annoyed by that, though.
I guess.
No, they're still crazy in love by the time they leave each other.
Yeah, but they do mention, I think, in point of the conversation, that eventually you get tired, you know. That you get tired of yourself because you're with yourself all the time, so you eventually get tired of other people as well.
That's true.
So I don't know. They know there are certain things that, you know, that is wrong with your person, and you know you're thinking maybe that eventually, you know, get on my nerves. So do I really want to, you know, risk it, or do you want to keep a memory of that person being nice? So I guess I guess you're right in that case. Also, it's pretty expensive to fly from California to Vienna.
I know. For her, it's no big deal, right? Yeah. Because she lives in Paris. Whereas for him, like, that's quite an investment to go there and run the risk of, you know, being jerked around.
Yeah. Unless he gets to see Vienna again or something, he gets to visit more.
Well, yeah, it's true that one day at one place, you don't get to visit that much. Yeah. So, yeah.
All right, so the question we always ask, would you recommend Before Sunrise?
It really depends on what you like. I mean, I would not recommend it personally, but, you know, if you don't like those kinds of real things and just people talking, don't watch that movie. It's a complete waste of time. If you're more like Dimitri and you kind of like the real stuff, yeah, it's completely for you. I can see that.
Yeah, I'm as you might have guessed, I'm going to go ahead and recommend it. Look, there's no other movie like it, to be perfectly blunt. Well, apart from the movies in the same series, I suppose.
Okay.
There's no other movie like these three movies. And just for that reason, if you're into cinema, I think it's worthwhile to add it to your catalog. And if you're in your 20s, oh, by all means, there's a fair chance that you're going to see yourself in these characters and maybe learn a little bit about yourself. Or just sort of inflate your vision of yourself and think you're way more romantic than you actually are. But either way, it's a fun experience.
Yeah.
All right, so Before Midnight. Where, again, it's another conversation with these two characters, and we get to catch up with them when they're in their 40s.
Wow. So they talk about geritol and stuff like that.
40s, really?
Yeah, yes.
40s?
Yes.
Okay.
When you hit 40, your life is over. That's my theory.
And that's why you've been 22 for 10 years now.
24. But yes, I mean, if the movie really has a cult following, you know, you really need to keep to the original and keep the same thing going. Although if they talk about stuff from, you know, that concerns in their 40s, is that going to really attract, you know, the 20s and, you know, the teens?
Well, I think it's going to attract the people who fell in love with the first movie and second movie, because it will follow their progression into life, if you will.
Okay. So that should be perfect, you know. If it's on a trend like that, if it's going great, and also the director is getting older, so they know what they're writing and, you know, directing about. So yeah, keep stay the course, is what I'm saying.
I agree, and yet.
Really?
Yeah, the thing about it is, one of the things about Before Sunrise and also Before Sunset, it's incredibly romantic to a certain degree. It's romantic in this hipster way that I personally detach from, because I'm a much more guarded person emotionally. Like, I would never have the sort of adventure this guy has, because I'm a more guarded person by nature. I would just sort of start interviewing the person that's talking to me instead of revealing anything about myself. That's just my nature, which is probably why I became a writer and an entertainer, because I feel more comfortable bearing my soul on a page and on a stage than I do just talking to a stranger.
Yeah.
Which is weird, but there you go. That's my life.
awesome.
And, but it is sort of a romantic ideal that they're presenting with these characters. It's sort of like, I've had this encounter once in a lifetime. And I've actually had that myself. Like, there are women in my life that I've had this moment where, oh, I could have gone on and dumped the girlfriend I was with and gone on with that person.
Yeah.
And sometimes I wonder what my life would have been if I had done that instead of going with another path.
Okay.
And you tend to romanticize that aspect of your life. Like, it's like, oh, I wonder if I had gone with that girl, it would have been something. Or maybe not, I don't know. But I hold a dear memory of that. And that's how we feel about these characters. They have that dear memory. And, you know, it ends on an ambiguous fashion for a reason, right? Because you want to keep that hope alive, but never spoil that dream, if you will.
Yeah.
What if, like, we see these characters once too many, and they lose their magic, they lose their mystique? They'll still be interesting as characters, but their love will no longer be something we root for, because we've seen them once too many.
I don't know. You think once per 10 years is too often, though? I mean,
well, here's the thing. Without going into spoilers,
yeah,
there's two ways that this could play out. Either they've hooked up the second time around.
Yeah.
In which case, when we meet them the third time around, they will have a relationship, and therefore we'll have to talk about
their relationship, the problems they might have had in their relationship. Because if it's a perfect relationship, it's not true. If it's an imperfect relationship, it loses a bit of its romance.
Okay.
Or alternatively, they didn't hook up the second time around and they get a third chance. And at that point, you're like, well, get your crap together, you losers. And I don't root for them either.
Okay.
So there is that danger of losing that romantic element.
Well, what if they hooked up with other people, though, and then they were just like going back and then they meet like that, you know, or
but
something?
But if we were back to scenario B where they've had that continuous chance to hook up and they don't do it. And I'm one of those people, like, you know, when I watch a TV show and they have the will they, won't they plot line?
Yeah.
Yeah. After a while, I'm like, well, look, you had your chances like 17 times at this point. I'm no longer rooting for your couple. Like, I don't care if you will or won't, you know?
Okay. So machine guns it is for you then?
What I'm saying is that it's quite possible that it'll just become an interesting character study and representation of generational differences.
Okay.
But it will no longer be a love affair that we can romanticize as viewers.
All right. I can see your point.
So that was my overly complicated thought on the matter.
That's a good thought. I you know. Stuff I didn't think about. I just, you know, I figured, you know, you keep the same recipe and it should be good, but you do make a good argument.
On that note, I guess.
Yeah.
If you want to share with us your thoughts on Before Sunrise, you can write us at mail@idiomatic.com or post a comment at idiomatic.com. We actually expect a fair bit of comments on this because I know how passionate this movie makes people, so... We totally want to read your thoughts on it. And if you can like us on Facebook, that would be awesome. We're also on Twitter. We're also on iTunes. And we will see you in just a few days because we're officially moving from Monday to Thursday to leave space for our new podcast series, The Idiomatic Top 3.
Giggity.